This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasuthi. Women and children are set to be the cornerstone of public health, yet in many countries, they are the first to be left behind to deal with issues such as unwanted or unsafe pregnancies, STDs and other infections. Clearly, something needs to be done and it is there that the Every Woman, Every Child movement fits in. Dr. Stefan German, he's the Director of Partnerships and Research from the Global Health and WASH team, World Vision International, tells me more. Welcome to the show, Dr. Stefan.
You're welcome.
Just before we go on, what does WASH really stand for?
Water and sanitation and hygiene.
Thank you very much.
Very cost-effective, important.
And hygiene. Right?
Hygiene. Okay. Specifically, like hand washing is one of the best public health inventions.
That's right. And after which is probably vaccinations.
Exactly. Yeah.
Dr. Stefan, could you just tell me a little bit more about your work? I understand you're based in Malaysia now over the last 1.5 years. What do you really do here?
World Vision is a large international non-governmental organization focusing on the health and well-being of children and women. Okay. And we use sort of approaches which benefits the entire communities where we work. So my role within World Vision International, we operate in 100 countries, is focusing on partnerships, innovation and accountability in the space of nutrition, health, HIV and water sanitation and hygiene programming.
Okay. And when did you embark upon this career at World Vision International?
With World Vision, I started in 2007, in 2005, and that was actually when the tsunami hit the region very badly, and I was stationed in Singapore and helping to coordinate the response, specifically in Aceh, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India and Thailand.
What was that experience like for you?
That was a very challenging experience, as you can imagine, with the loss of lives of nearly 300,000 people, the devastation in communities. But what was really strong was to see the resilience in communities, how they immediately started to rebuild, and with a desire to rebuild better in terms of more disaster prone sort of housing, so that it's more secure for future disasters. And that was sort of my first experience in the region. I used to spend more time in Africa before that.
Okay. Asia and Africa are two areas, I think, which most organizations are focusing on when it comes to a lot of social work. What do you think is the difference between Africa and Asia in your line of work? And you're looking at what, as you mentioned, nutrition, HIV, sanitation and hygiene.
I think one very important message for the listeners to the show is that whilst we kind of often have the image of African children who are malnourished and not healthy, is whilst the percentage is true in terms of percentage of our whole population, the total numbers of malnourished children in Asia and the total numbers of pregnant women who still die in childbirth is actually larger in Asia. And so while the percentage towards the total population is smaller, just because of the large population groups in Asia, the total number is actually much greater.
Is there a reason for that?
I think there is a reason for that, and partly is that we have seen rapid economic growth in the region, which we need to celebrate and applaud. But the issue is that we have seen economic growth not necessarily matched with equity in terms of people accessing the health benefits from this growth. And I think that's for the Asia region. A big challenge. Mm-hmm.
So the distribution of wealth is actually
exactly
what you're talking
yes,
about.
Yeah.
There is something called the Every Woman, Every Child movement. You just want to shed more light on what that is?
Sure. There is this Millennium Development Goals, which have been established in the year 2000 up to 2015. Mm-hmm. And two of these goals, one is particularly focusing on reducing maternal mortality, as we still have too many women die at the moment when there should be joy and celebration of a newborn child, but they die in childbirth. And then we have still just about sort of below 7 million children die every year, mainly from preventable diseases. And so these two Millennium Development Goals, it's 4 and 5, are really lagging behind. And so the UN Secretary General in 2010, Ban Ki-moon, he launched this global movement called Every Woman, Every Child, which is supported by the Global Strategy for Women's and Children's Health. And the aim was to create a multi-stakeholder platform from business, from NGOs, UN agencies, governments, and academia to really get together and accelerate the effort to make a significant impact and save 16 million lives over that time span of 5 years.
That's
where
right.
This movement is.
Global Strategy for Women's and Children's Health, 2010 it was launched. It's been 3 years now. $40 billion US dollars was allocated at that time over the five-year period ending 2015. As you said, to save 16 million women and children, preventing 33 million unwanted pregnancies was your target, ending stunting in 88 million children and protecting about 120 million children from pneumonia by 2015. After 3 years, how far do you think you've come?
It's quite remarkable, actually, the how the movement has created to get results. And I strongly believe that an important aspect was that immediately when this global strategy was launched, Ban Ki-moon put in place a commission on information and accountability to develop a very solid accountability framework. And so one of the pieces is to have an independent expert review group. And I was just at a meeting this morning at 7 o'clock at the Women Deliver conference,
yes,
where Prime Minister Najib was speaking yesterday. And this independent expert review group is looking at all the different stakeholders who made pledges to this Every Woman, Every Child movement, whether we are on track. This is matched by a fairly strong scientific process called Countdown to 2015, mm-hmm, which reviews every country's key indicators in the space of maternal and newborn and child health and reproductive health and keeps track. So this pressure on all the stakeholders has been very beneficial to deliver for children and women's health.
Okay, the fact that you're based in Malaysia is also part of this strategy, global strategy. What have we been doing here?
Malaysia has been a good example of really good policy choices and making the right investments in the past many years. And as we've heard yesterday in the opening plenary at Women Deliver, we can really see that Malaysia has made significant progress. We do see, though, that I think on the nutrition side, Malaysia needs to watch very carefully in terms of like some of the more rural areas and like East Malaysia, where we do see when you work at the field level that some of the indicators need to be carefully watched. And I think the government is well aware of this, because we need to make sure that, again, it's one Malaysia. We need to all grow together as the economy grows, and not just Selangor and Johor and
That's
some
right.
of the centres.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, we talk about the uneven distribution of wealth in, you know, countries that are growing with affluence and things like that. But there is also this disparity when it comes to undernourishment and overnourishment. Would you say that's the case? I mean, because we're sitting in the Klang Valley and talking about things like obesity, whereas I'm sure you're talking about the reverse when it comes to Sarawak, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly a very important factor. So World Vision Malaysia, which is sort of the World Vision International affiliate for Malaysia, they decided about 2 years ago to start in Sabah and parts of East Malaysia to do actually specific programs, mm-hmm, for more vulnerable children and their communities, in recognition that we need to work on this. But you brought up as well the issue of obesity, and that's really a concern specifically related to childhood obesity in changing lifestyles where children, specifically in urban context, don't have enough physical exercise. Parents have to drive them to school. They unfortunately start to increasingly prefer some hamburgers rather than a nasi lemak.
I have no idea which is worse, really, at this stage.
But I think what is really encouraging, and that's where I bring it now to Every Woman, Every Child, which is sort of the power of partnerships. And World Vision, with some private sector partners, with some companies, just is in the process to launch with the Asian Football Confederation, which is actually situated here. They have their headquarters in Kuala Lumpur, mm-hmm, to have a 10-year nutrition campaign, which looks on one hand on undernutrition in terms of children born too small, and there's still large numbers of children in Asia born too small, and they can never really fully develop to have full strong sports teams as soccer, as football requires, mm-hmm. but as well to address the issue of obesity and utilize football and the passion people have in football to foster physical activity and address some of the issues related to good nutrition.
You know, Dr. Stefan, very often initiatives like these are driven by, you know, the private sector, civil society, but are leaders from governments working with you, and are they open to this? Is it really a priority?
In many countries, it is. In many countries, it is. I wouldn't say we can't generalize it, but one important stakeholder group, which in the past has been neglected, but like World Vision, we started working quite a bit with them, is parliamentarians. And we want to see that parliamentarians are much more aware of the importance of health and nutrition for well-being of their citizens. And it's really this issue of what we call democratizing health. We need citizens to be much more active in terms of their own lifestyle choices, and then be very active in terms of how they shape their health delivery systems.
Mm-hmm. In many countries in the world, you find that people constantly politicize issues. There is this possibility with initiatives like these. Have you seen it happen?
It can happen, but increasingly, and I'm quite involved in what is called global health diplomacy, and specifically on the area of multi-stakeholder diplomacy. And what we do need to do is, in the past, we tried to, when there was sort of potential conflict of interest or things like this where we feared it might be too politicized, we tried not to engage with each other. That is outdated. In the 21st century, and we really need to be able to manage these dynamics and develop capabilities to manage potential conflict of interest as we engage with private sector, with public sector. And I think that would bring me to the Innovation Working Group Asia chapter, which we launched yesterday evening at the Every Woman, Every Child, where we had a representative from the UN Secretary General. Mm-hmm. We had the Malaysia UNICEF representative. We had the Dean of the Medical School of the University of Malaya, Professor Adiba Kamaluzan, and this demonstrated exactly that power, that if in the 21st century we want to find solutions to complex health and nutrition problems for women's and children's health, we need partnerships. We can't do it alone.
When we come back, we'll find out more about the Every Woman, Every Child movement. Dr. Stefan German, he's actually here in Malaysia, based here with World Vision International. He's Director of Partnerships and Research at the Global Health and WASH team, WASH meaning the Water Sanitation and Hygiene, isn't it, is what it stands
Correct,
for.
Yeah.
Also delivering a paper at the Women Deliver Conference. When we come back, we'll find out more. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture, and it's Mira Sivasodi. The Every Woman, Every Child movement is an interesting one. It's a global movement to mobilize and intensify global action to improve the health of women and children around the world. With me, Dr. Stefan German. He's the Director of Partnerships and Research, Global Health and WASH team, World Vision International. We're discussing the importance of health in terms of nutrition for women and children. You know, Dr. Stefan, research has conclusively demonstrated that the health of women and children is the cornerstone of public health. Yet why is it many governments don't recognize this?
I think the key issue is empowerment. And quite often in many societies, unfortunately, we still face a situation that specifically the voice of children is not taken that serious. Even the voice of young people, adolescents, which in many countries are actually the majority of the population, And even women's voices are still not regarded as that sort of important. Mm-hmm. that is changing, and I was very pleased to hear yesterday the Prime Minister of Malaysia acknowledging that today in Malaysia, I think there's more than 60% of university students in Malaysia are now women.
Yes.
But he acknowledged as well that if you then go a few years later into the workforce, and if you look at the earning potential, that even in Malaysia, that actually the number of women is below 50% within the workforce. And if you go further to actually look at income disparities, there is still major issues to address in Malaysia.
Yeah. And well, women staying, you know, staying in the workforce is the other challenge, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Carry on.
But that's where we need to do realize that if we actually would bring women much more into the workforce and create more flexi time, a bit more flexibility around arrangements, that this has significant economic growth potential. It benefits families, it benefits children, because role models start to change as you have more women taking leadership positions. And I think the world is aware of this, but I think it's us men to some extent too, who are a hindrance, but as well some many women who just, you know, they don't want to get out of this sort of probably role which is defined by them by sort of traditional cultural mm-hmm. societal expectations.
That's right. You know, sometimes even I'm in a dilemma. I mean, we come to work, we go back, and then we're expected in a way to also contribute towards societal health in this case, and this is what you're actually championing. And sometimes it's impossible to do everything. So Dr. Stefan, I mean, what are your thoughts on this? As you said, the men are missing in the picture here.
I do think that requires a fundamental rethink of gender roles, and I think we see that if you live together and you both are making an income, you just have to share your household chores as well, and I think that is really where men clearly need to radically move forward, mm-hmm. where men have a tendency to get home and sort of, you know, read the newspaper. But it's economically unfair, so it's unjust. So if both go into the workplace, I mean, you get home and you basically have to share and get agreement to this, and that benefits, again, it benefits greatly society if we can make that shift. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we will see a lot of pressure, and we will see sort of rates, well, I don't know the Malaysian context, but in other situations we see that rates of divorce is increasing because you know, these shares are not equally shared, and that has negative impact on children and society long term.
Are you saying, I mean are we referring to the urban society when it comes to problems like these as opposed to the rural areas?
I do feel that the rapid urbanization, and we see, I mean, in Asia, it's amazing if you look at how many people every year move into the city and how urbanization is taking a rapid sort of move forward. And that requires a rethink of what policy choices are we taking to actually create that enabling environment.
Okay, and so in that case, just coming back to the global strategy for women's and children's health, so what will be your focus? What areas of health really? And, you know, is it going to differ from the urban areas as well as the rural areas?
The difference is not really there. I think the primary focus which we as World Vision have, and if we look at the Every Woman, Every Child, is really the frontline response. We need more community health workers, absolutely critical to have people who are really within communities. We clearly need as well to invest and step up on family planning. We need to invest more on nutrition, and nutrition from the Copenhagen Consensus, which brings together the leading sort of world's economists for the third year in an independent way, have said that investing into nutrition, specifically micronutrients, is one of the most cost-effective development interventions. We know as well that about one-third of all related child deaths are actually caused by undernutrition. So even if you die from, let's say, an infectious disease, quite often it's actually that your immune system is weakened by lack of nutrients. And so the other one is obviously water sanitation and hygiene, which is absolutely critical.
What would you say is Malaysia's pressing concern right now?
I think Malaysia's pressing concerns would be to continue strong on the sort of family planning trajectory, which I think has been stronger in the past, but it's kind of needs to be continued. It is as well on the nutrition side. I do think that we do need to look carefully. And that's a challenge that in many Asian countries, it's kind of seen as normal that people are shorter.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually look at how Netherlands is a good example, how the average size of the population in Netherlands over the last 18 years has kind of, because of nutrition interventions, grown by about 18 centimeters. And the benefit that has to the economy is phenomenal.
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
There is a health economist which focuses on nutrition, and Susan Horton from the Waterloo University in Canada, who has been advising this Copenhagen consensus. And she looked specifically at India. And she basically says if India would tackle childhood stunting, where I think it was last year where the Indian Prime Minister actually acknowledged that it's a national shame that almost half of all the Indian children are actually stunted. And so if they would tackle all of this, India could add another 5 to 6% of GDP growth.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Have there been roadblocks in terms of trying to get these women and children to help or to help themselves to get this assistance that they require?
There are roadblocks. And I think one of the key roadblocks is the lack of allocating domestic financial resources. Less an issue in Malaysia, but countries which have received sort of overseas development assistance. And for me, like Vietnam is a good example. I mean, Vietnam is not currently investing enough into specific efforts on women's and children's health. But I read a couple of months ago in The Economist that they are investing a couple of billion dollars into upgrading the Navy. Mm. So the resources are there. But what are we
prioritizing
in terms of the investment which we are making? So we're working at the moment. I'm part of the Partnership for Maternal Newborn Child Health, which is hosting this innovation working group. And we are developing a global investment framework for women's and children's health.
Okay. You're working with a lot of other stakeholders as well. I mean, has that been a challenge for you? Getting everyone on the same page?
I actually thrive with having sort of multi-stakeholder partnership. That's when I get a life. And I think I would put a challenge to, given that you're a sort of a business-focused radio channel, I would want to put a challenge to the business. We have to acknowledge that in the 21st century, the kind of traditional corporate social responsibility, which is still in Malaysia and many parts more sort of a check-writing, charitable model, mm-hmm. is outdated. The new way is really about creating shared value. And if you run a business or you are influential in your company, you need to think, how can I leverage my company's core assets to improve societal outcomes? And then how can I partner with non-governmental organizations from civil society? How can I partner with government together that we get the best results? And that's called sort of convergence economies. And it becomes increasingly what we call stakeholder agnostic. So it's about leveraging your assets. So let's take health. Obviously, the Ministry of Health is not best placed to manage supply chain of essential medicines in rural sort of, you know, East Malaysia. We have excellent supply chain companies in this country. So why don't we leverage that asset and bring in that expertise and see who is best placed, whereas government is very important for the regulatory framework for all of this. But if we create that innovative space of bringing each one's sort of comparative advantage to the table, and that's where we are pushing corporate social responsibility to move.
Who ideally should lead this? I mean, that's obviously what's the gap in all of this, isn't it? Should it be somebody like World Vision? Should it be government? Should it be the public sector? Who should ideally manage all of this and keep everyone together and on the same page?
I think that's where we need to create shared leadership. And it needs sort of passionate leaders on each of these sectors of private sector, government, and the civil society. And I think the leadership, if we move towards a shared leadership sort of paradigm, is really the way to go. And again, linking it to the Innovation Working Group Asia under this Every Woman, Every Child, which we launched yesterday, one of the speakers had, I think it was Professor Adiba Kamaluzan from the dean of the medical school here. She brought the brilliant Brazilian song phrase into it, and she said, if we dream alone, things stay just a dream. If we dream together, we create a new reality. And so the idea of these partnerships between government, private sector, academia, civil society, and we work together in leveraging each other's assets, that's when we can turn our collective dreams into very tangible results.
What does it mean to pledge a commitment to a movement like this?
Like World Vision, we pledged our global CEO and president, Kevin Jenkins. He made a pledge in 2010 at the table with the UN Secretary General that World Vision will invest $1.5 billion over a five-year period into women's and children's health.
Okay.
So we made a pledge. It's about a one page with more details to it. And we actually keep track by using an independent expert validation process from a law accounting firm who kind of looks at whether we deliver on this. And I've got the good news. We actually will probably spend and deliver more than what we have promised. So the same is like private sector. We have Johnson & Johnson made a major pledge. We have this Royal DSM in the micronutrient vitamins space. There's a couple of, I can't remember the exact figure, but there's probably almost 100 private sector companies who made pledges. I remember the Body Shop making a pledge as well. Mm-hmm. And it's really that power of creating a movement where everybody can put his assets and comparative advantage into a movement to create the shared outcome.
How are these commitments and finances then mobilized? I mean, it comes to you, and how do you decide where it goes and which areas need to be looked at?
We have quite clarity in terms of where are the biggest gaps. So obviously, like in this region, we have quite significant gaps in Myanmar, which we need to address. Mm-hmm. Large population with some challenging context in transition, opening up some great opportunities. India, whilst it has sufficient domestic resources, there are issues of assisting India in terms of policy alignment and really make sure that the sort of economic growth is benefiting the majority of people. We work quite closely in Indonesia with a very large population, which I mean, I'm quite impressed with the Indonesian government with some of their policy choices they are taking. But then we have countries in the region like Papua New Guinea, which really struggles, which has a not very good track record, but the willingness to move forward.
Well, that is the problem, isn't it? Some countries have the money, some really don't.
Exactly.
Then what do you do then?
So that is sort of where the global community comes in, and that was actually one of the discussion points, that a bit of a challenge is with the sort of economic still sort of challenges Europe faces and North America, which traditionally has been a large donor on some of the more vulnerable countries. Because of domestic pressure, these governments become very selective, and we actually call then some countries like the orphan of development aid. So they don't get sufficient support. Mm-hmm. And if you take, let's say, an African country like Niger or Chad, where it, you know, they're not really big on the international agenda.
Yep.
And some of these countries really are not getting sufficient support.
And with this help or aid that, you know, you're working on in Asia to empower more women and children towards, you know, better health, how do you think this will have a global impact? How do you think that will happen? Or what will be the global impact?
Well, there's two folds. One is accountability to global agreements. So in 2000, when these Millennium Development Goals were set, they were very clear, measurable targets. And we owe it to future generations that if we set global commitments, that we actually leverage to make it happen. The resources are there. I mean, that is very clear. I mean, we have sufficient resources and sufficient, you know, genius and brain in this world that we can actually address all of these issues if we want so.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at, you know, sort of a cafe latte basically buys you immunization for a child.
Yep.
And so why don't we do it? And I think that's where we need much more collective actions. And that's what inspires me. Like when I sort of go back in my own personal sort of life, I used to work with Swatch, was quite successful, microengineering in a Swiss sort of context. But, you know, when you have sufficient shoes and you have your car and you have all of this, you kind of ask yourself, well, there should be more than just buying another pair of shoe or maybe a new car. And what do I do? And, I, you know, that's probably sort of my last sort of challenges to your listeners is, you know, ask yourself when you get up, you know, what do I do? What do I contribute to this country? But not just to this country. What do I contribute as a global citizen to this global village? And find one thing which you're passionate about and then follow through with it. And that is sort of very inspirational, and you can get passionate about it. And like this, collectively, we change the world.
Oh, I love that inspiration. It is an inspiration indeed. Dr. Stefan, in my mind, you know, your optimism aside, my pessimist self is telling me local governments is a huge obstacle when it comes to implementing programs like this. How do you overcome that?
Quite often, obstacles are as well part of the solution. So I do agree that sort of local government is at times a challenging sort of, which can be a roadblock in the sort of journey to really make tremendous progress. But we have the experience that there are two key issues how you can address this. And the first one is empowerment of citizens to be fully aware of what does the government system in terms of policies and legislation actually promise you as a citizen to deliver. And we, World Vision, has developed together with the World Bank an approach which we call now Citizen Voice in Action. And that's an approach which then really looks at what are some of the deliveries which should take place in your local community from government and other services. And then you develop as a community key performance indicators and you regularly measure that. The second one is we have neglected in the past to work closer with parliaments and parliamentarians as the representative of citizens. And so if you match these two, what I would call what has been missing is that a lot of things have been top down, sort of central government, and it's kind of pushed down without actually having accountability feedback loop at the local level and then from local to sort of provincial. But with these sort of, and that's where the Innovation Working Group with technologies comes in. We just developed at the moment, it's not yet ready, a database on these issues of citizen voices in action. And you can use then some sort of like a Facebook page where you can collectively measure as a community members these key performance indicators which the community has set themselves in regards to government service delivery. And if you look at the power this has over time, I mean, I'm driving a motorbike here in Kuala Lumpur.
Are you really?
I am. And I felt we should have an app as motorbike drivers, and maybe your radio station would help to do that, mm-hmm. of where each pothole which could kill my life as a motorbike driver, I just take on my phone a photograph, and it's GSI coded, and I post it on that website. And basically, the local government has to make sure it fixes this pothole. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it stays thousands of these on that web page. So you put on a citizen's accountability feedback loop, and I'm sure most motorbike riders would be pleased to do that. Because if you're behind the car and a pothole comes and you're too late, I mean, you can be dead.
Yeah.
So that's the same idea, is give citizens a tool to monitor government services in health, education, whatever. So that's why I'm quite hopeful, because technology is on our side.
What do you think is going to happen after 2015, Dr. Stefan?
There are big discussions right now. There is sort of a big global process, and all the governments are in sort of involved, including the Malaysian governments, of what we call the post-millennium development goal process. There was a very big meeting earlier in the year in Bali hosted by the president of Indonesia. Mm-hmm. He's one of the sort of lead group with Prime Minister Cameroon and an African president. We strongly feel that there is unfinished business within the existing Millennium Development Goals, specifically around women's and children's health. So we need to keep that one high on the agenda. Mm-hmm. we need to focus on a global agenda which is more inclusive of all the countries, because we all have to address certain issues, some environmental issues related to sustainability development agenda. We, as World Vision, are as well very strongly pushing that nutrition is going to be high on the agenda. Both, again, if you look at how unhealthy food markets in urban context is driving the whole growth of non-communicable diseases like heart diseases, which are all lifestyle, diabetes type 2, etc. And that creates huge burden on societies. There was two years ago, I think, there was the UN high-level summit at the UN General Assembly on non-communicable diseases, and they, the World Health Organization with Harvard Public School of Health, they did some studies related to the cost of inaction. And if we are not tackling these lifestyle diseases of diabetes, cardiovascular, lungs related to smoking, which is a big problem in Malaysia and in Indonesia, it's cost the global economy trillions of dollars in the next 25 years and actually is reducing GDP growth because these sort of chronic illnesses will put a huge strain on government's health budgets. And so we need collectively to find ways how can we, with business, etc., you know, create more healthy lifestyle in urban context. We have to figure that out.
Are you optimistic going forward?
Yeah, I am optimistic, yes. And because there's two things. Is one, because we know what to do. And with lifestyle issues, obviously it takes a bit of time and pain till we actually do what we know is the right thing to do. So that's one element why I'm very optimistic. The other one is if you work in the space of improving the lives of the most vulnerable children in this world, if you don't stay optimistic and hopeful, you become cynical. And I actually challenged all my best friends and said, the day I start to become cynical, tell me, because that's when I quit the job. Because cynicism kills hope. And if you don't have hope, then you don't have that driving inspiration to drive the change you want to see in this world.
Thank you. I'll remember that every time.
Thank you.
If you'd like more information on Every Woman, Every Child, just log on to the website, which is everywomaneverychild.org. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Stefan Girman, the Director of Partnerships and Research, Global Health and the WASH Team, or from World Vision International on the Every Woman, Every Child movement on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.